Thank you for tuning in to today's edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. On this week's My Ag Life and Citrus episode, Taylor Chalstrom brings us information on the sweet mother orange trees released from quarantine and the Citrus Clonal Protection Program's role in this. And we get a report about beneficial fungi for pest management in orchards. I'll bring you national and regional agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news, right after this word from our sponsor.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
In regional agricultural news, although farm and food production workers were considered essential workers during the pandemic, many of California's food employers endangered those workers, violating the California OSHA COVID-19 guidelines more often than most industries, according to a new report. The California Institute for Rural Studies' report said farm and food production employers routinely failed to provide workers with face masks, nor did they enforce physical distancing or notify workers when there were COVID-19 outbreaks at work sites. The study was based on OSHA inspections from April 2020 through December of 2021. Though farms and food companies had the most violations of all the industries, they had some of the smallest penalties, according to the report. The average penalty was $22,473. California OSHA did not answer Cal Matters' questions about the size of the fines and issued a statement saying that Cal OSHA recognizes and appreciates the importance of this issue and is reviewing the report and recommendations. Deborah Saxton, a researcher with the Rural Studies Institute, said California OSHA cited food production employers four times more than any other California industries during the first year of the pandemic, but food companies utilize the judicial and appeals process to reduce their penalties. Oftentimes, the fines will be reduced or eliminated, she said. They know that the food production employers and the companies are producing for have very powerful legal teams to reduce the fines. The companies' violations often included failure to provide and implement a health and safety system, which is required by 1991 state law, according to the study. The report describes food production workers as those working in meatpacking, dairy operations, and agriculture, primarily Black, Latino, and Indigenous people, often undocumented immigrants. California agriculture produces one-third of the country's vegetables, two-thirds of its fruits and nuts, and generates around $50 billion in annual revenue. California is the nation's breadbasket, and they help feed much of the world by exporting over $20 billion in agricultural commodities every year. According to the San Diego County Farm Bureau, the county's agricultural production ranks 19th out of over 3,000 counties nationwide. Much of that agriculture is centered in the 75th Assembly District. But agriculture is vulnerable, dependent on weather, unstable markets, fertilizer cost availability, and many other factors. And the state is in a drought, something that is not uncommon, but for decades, the state has taken no action to increase water storage, according to the San Diego County Farm Bureau. And if that's not enough, now there's another problem. Cyber and ransomware attacks on agricultural companies. Throughout the U.S., federal data shows that cyber attacks are increasing, with an estimated 47,000 nationwide, resulting in payouts totaling $1.2 billion across all sectors of the economy. With more growers and livestock companies using precision farming and tech in their operations, this could become a common issue. In April, the FBI put the ag industry on alert after a series of cyber attacks targeting grain cooperatives. Criminals may consider agriculture an easy target, one of that reaps immediate rewards. For example, disrupting seed supplies during planting season or shutting down a dairy's operations, creating spoilage problems, can generate quick payouts from victims to criminals. The FBI is recommending increased ag cybersecurity. Those measures include backup data regularly and keep password-protected copies offline. Identify critical functions and devise plans for operating manually. Install operating system updates and patches as they become available. Use antivirus and anti-malware software. Use multi-factor authentication when possible. And use complex passwords and change them regularly. California farmers remain stressed about drought conditions and limited water that is also affecting their crop insurance protections. Those are a few of the issues raised last week by farmers as Representative Jim Costa, Democrat of California, and a senior member of the House Agriculture Committee held a farm bill listening session in his home district. Farmers talked about the prolonged impact of the drought and some of the holes in the farm safety net. Mark McKeon, a farmer from Fresno County, said reductions of both state and federal water had cut water allocations to anywhere from 10% down to zero. He said that productive farmland is being fallowed, and he is fallowing his own farm. The University of California, Merced, looked at the 2021 drought in the state earlier this year and estimated 395,000 acres of crops were fallowed in the state, and the agriculture sector directly lost about $1.1 billion. Right now, there is no part of California that is not in some level of drought, with much of the Central Valley and Costa's congressional district in D4 exceptional drought conditions, the worst level of drought intensity measured by the U.S. Drought Monitor. Most of the state has been in at least D3 extreme drought for at least a year. The cutbacks on irrigated water go back even further in time. The loss of irrigated water and fallowing of ground also translates to the need for maintaining preventive planting crop insurance and building in more flexibility into risk management agency rules. McKeon pointed to the RMA's 1-in-4 rule that requires farmers to plant and harvest a crop in 1 out of every 4 years to be eligible for prevent plant coverage on that ground. He said this is extremely problematic due to the current drought facing the West. He added they have extremely productive farmland, and it has a long history of being so. If this drought lasts longer than the arbitrary numbers chosen by RMA, they will start losing this coverage unless changes are made for irrigated crops. In a reply to DTN, a USA spokeswoman stated on Friday the 1-in-4 rule was expanded nationally for spring crops in 2021 and expanded to apply to all crops for the 2022 crop year. The changes were also retroactive in 2021, meaning a crop had to have been planted and harvested in 1 year during the 2017 to 2020 crop years. Drought was added as a cause for loss as well. As for the dairy industry, Jeffrey Vandenhuvo, a director of regulatory and economic affairs at Milk Producers Council, noted the dairy margin coverage program only covers about 5 million pounds of milk, production of roughly 250 cows. Costa noted that does not work very well in California. The typical dairy farm in California is significantly larger than that, but Vandenhuvo said the Milk Producers Council recognizes the financial and political constraints of expanding DMC despite the limited protections for larger operations. He said larger milk producers have found a safety net in a dairy revenue protection program, an insurance program that does not cap the size of the operation. Dairy farmers can get 90 to 95% revenue coverage, and a policy right now has a 44% premium subsidy. If additional funds could be found, increasing the premium subsidy by even 5 to 10% would likely increase dairy farmer participation in the DRP, according to Vandenhuvo.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
A report now from Taylor Charlstrom on the Sweet Mother Orange's trees released from quarantine and the Citrus Clonal Protection Program's role in the release.
The 1,000th tree okayed for growing by California's Citrus Clonal Protection Program happens to be the oldest living orange variety in the state. The Citrus Clonal Protection Program, housed at UC Riverside, is the first of its kind in the world. It began in the 1950s, and its scientists spend up to 3 years testing and clearing citrus trees of disease so they can be released to commercial and private growers.
The federal government in the United States declared the citrus as a prohibited species to enter the United States unless if comes through a program like the CCPP. So there is currently, to the best of my knowledge, three individuals in the country, three programs in the country, in the United States, that they are issued a special permit that allows to proceed with the safe introduction of citrus varieties into the United States. And into individual states.
That was Georgios Vitalakis, Program Director for the Citrus Clonal Protection Program. This recent 1,000th tree release, the Sweet Mother Orange tree, had to endure testing for more than 30 citrus diseases, whether those diseases are known to have emerged in the state or not. Having passed resistance for all of these, the tree has proven itself to be a rugged variety, which Vitalakis said is good for the citrus industry in the United States and globally.
The citrus industry globally is facing the threat of the Huanglongbing disease, the HLB disease. And sustainable solutions to this disease will come from a systems approach that will include management of the vector of the Asian citrus psyllid, of removal of inoculum. But we hope that eventually in the heart of that systems approach to deal with the disease would be rootstocks or scions that they have tolerance or resistance to the disease. So having access to genetic resources, to genotypes, citrus genotypes that they have, in this case, survived since the 1850s, almost completely unintended, right? And this tree has had, if we can call it, a rough life. It has been growing in cold environments. I believe has been dug up and transplanted a couple of times because it was near the Oroville Dam up in that area, in the Bidwell Bar area. And that was the reason that the not only its historical significance, but because genetically speaking, it's a tough cookie, if we can call it that way. It was introduced several years ago at the citrus variety collection at UC Riverside, the Zivandan citrus variety collection at UC Riverside. So when all of us, including the industry and the researchers, were thinking genetic diversity and citrus that may be tolerant to all sorts of stresses, this variety came up in a conversation with a dear friend, Tom Delfino, that used to be the managing director of the California Citrus Nursery Society. He said, you know, the Bidwell Bar mother orange trees in the variety collection, you should put it in the program and have available budwood for researchers, for growers. It's a good opportunity to do this. And that's exactly what we did.
Vitalakis noted that in terms of prolific diseases in the industry, like Huanglongbing, aka citrus greening disease, the sweet mother orange tree isn't expected to have better resistance to the disease than other trees, but it is expected to have good resistance to environmental stressors, which leave trees open to more disease issues.
Was the idea that this tree has responded through the centuries very well overall to stress, as we said, transplant stress and cold weather stress, and maybe we can identify genetic footprints, you know, genes activated or deactivated during those stress events that they can help us. Because disease, it's essentially a thing more or less, right? Puts stress on the tree and the tree responds to that stress. It's abiotic stress, based on the example we're talking about, the mother tree versus biotic stress that they are in the case of a bacterial infection like the Huanglongbing disease. They are different pathways and mechanisms, of course, but again, the idea of having a tree surviving on its own through centuries and under lots of stresses, could provide some valuable genetic information.
Overall, Vitalakis and the other researchers at the Citrus Clonal Protection Program say it's important to preserve the genetic material from a tree with such significance to California.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
In national agricultural news, A coalition of almost 100 American food and agriculture organizations called for the prompt confirmation of Doug McCallop as a chief agriculture negotiator in the U.S. Trade Representative's office. In a letter to the U.S. Senate Finance Committee, the groups highlighted McCallop's deep knowledge of the food and agriculture industry and his institutional, regulatory, and trade experience. The groups also note that McCallop has the experience necessary to tackle some of the most pressing trade policy issues the industry is facing. Doug McCallop is an excellent nominee for the critical role of chief agricultural negotiator, especially as the U.S. needs to increase global trade and secure greater market access for U.S. products, according to John Bode, president and CEO of the Corn Refiners Association. The group of associations that sent the letter endorsing McCallop includes much of the food and agricultural sector that's responsible for about one-fifth of the country's economic activity. World food prices fell for the third straight month in June. However, the United Nations Food Agency says those prices are close to record levels set in March. The Food and Agriculture Organization's Food Price Index tracks the most globally traded food commodities, and the index averaged 154.2 in June. That's down from 157.9 in May. Despite the drop, the June index was over 23% higher than at the same time last year. The FAO's chief economist says the factors that drove global food prices higher in the first place are still in play. In the cereal supply and demand estimates, the FAO raised its global production estimates to 2.79 billion tons, still 6% lower than in 2021. The cereal index dropped 4.1% from May, but was still almost 28% higher than last year. The vegetable oil price index fell 7.6%, while the meat index rose 1.7%. Will this year's agricultural exports reach the record high levels being projected? USDA Ag News reporter Gary Crawford has the story.
When it comes to sales of U.S. ag products to foreign customers, the Agriculture Department says for the first 8 months of this fiscal year, October through May,
exports so far are $136.5 billion.
USDA economist Bart Kenner. So with 4 months to go in the fiscal year, we've racked up $136.5 billion in export sales. And USDA's been forecasting that for the entire 2022 fiscal year, we could rack up a record $191 billion of exports.
So that $191 billion is an increase of 11% over last year. Currently, we are 12% higher than this time last year.
And so as far as making that forecast, Kenner says our export pace so far
seems to be on track.
Not so on track, though, are ag imports. Kenner says USDA's been forecasting ag product imports to hit $180.5 billion. That would be about 11% more than a year ago. But imports now are running 21% above last year. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The ethanol industry is hopeful of a final win soon on a permanent fix for restricted summertime E15 sales. The House has already acted as part of a package of livestock competition bills to permanently allow summertime E15 sales that received a Biden waiver just for this summer. Now, Renewable Fuels Association Chief Jeff Cooper says it's up to the Senate to act.
We are expecting that the Senate is going to give those provisions a very hard look if they decide to try and do something before the August recess.
As for E15 chances after seven Midwest Republicans broke ranks and backed the House bill,
we would expect the same thing to happen in the Senate. In fact, there's probably more bipartisan interest in the Senate around the provisions that were in that bill that slipped through the House.
And ahead of the November elections, both parties will be looking for anything they can point to as possibly reducing near-record gas prices. The potato industry faces issues like all of agriculture, including a pandemic, supply chain disruptions, and the war in Ukraine. A new forecast shows COVID-19-related food service closures and a sector's lagging full recovery still loom over growers upstream, increasing uncertainty and keeping a lid on acreage growth. Al Mayhem, Rabo Research Analyst for Fresh Produce, says it really started in 2019.
We started in the fall of 2019, we had short supply. The following year, we planted less acreage because of COVID. So that led to a smaller area, which meant less supply. Then last year, we had a very dry and hot season in the North Pacific region. And that led to one of the weakest yields in the last 10, 15 years, which also led to a smaller crop. You add in the equation short supply, strong demand, that equates strong prices.
Add to that, the war in Ukraine has impacted planting decisions this spring.
The impact was indirect. In Ukraine and Russia, there's not much going on with the potato being imported from them or exported to them. However, through the impact on grain market and energy market, potato sector here in the U.S. was, like any other agricultural sector, affected to a large degree. For example, the high prices of wheat, which potato growers who on rotational years, they could grow wheat part of their rotation. The rate at which the prices of grains have gone up since the war is faster than the one on potatoes.
The forecast from Robo Research says the high input prices, a bullish post-pandemic market, and diminished weather concerns combine to boost 2022 projections. Rabobank analysts predict the annual average fresh potato and processing potato prices to increase to $13.70 and $11 per hundredweight, respectively. Average potato yield is expected to rebound around 6.6% year over year.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Taylor Charlstrom is back with another report talking about beneficial fungi for pest management in orchards.
Entomopathogenic or beneficial fungi are safe biopesticides that are commercially available and used to control a wide variety of economically important insect pests in various cropping systems, including in pecan orchards. Some of these fungi can kill pecan pests such as pecan weevil and pecan aphids. The beneficial fungi are usually applied to the crop just like chemical insecticides using standard spray equipment, according to David Shapiro Ilon, a research leader in USDA ARS's Southeastern Fruit and Tree Nut Research Laboratory.
They're really safe bioinsecticides, therefore, relative to some other tactics, such as some of the chemical insecticides, they're much safer to the environment, safer to humans and other non-target organisms. So that's a benefit in itself. You have some of these fungi that occur naturally in our orchards. For example, here in Georgia and the Southeast states, we've surveyed and found most orchards have some level of these natural fungi in them. And some of them may kill pests, for example, pecan weevil, which is a key pest of pecan in our region. You might get 40% mortality just based on the native endemic fungi that are in the soil. But then on top of that, if you can take commercial products that have these fungi and spray that in the orchard, apply that in the orchard, and then get much higher levels of control of the target pests.
In many cases, these beneficial fungi are already present in orchards, and Shapiro Ilon said there are ways to enhance the environment to make it more conducive to these fungi.
Planting clover in the pecan orchard enhances the native fungi because these fungi are sensitive to UV radiation and they like a certain level of soil moisture, which when you have a cover crop like that, it's going to make it more conducive to the fungus, so you'll get a higher level of the fungus. Or if you've applied the fungus to the soil, it's going to persist longer when you have ground covers and things like that. But as far as applying the fungi, pretty much any standard agricultural spray equipment is going to work for the fungi, as well as, you know, applying chemical insecticides. You just follow the manufacturer's label. Generally just adding it to your spray tank and applying in the same fashion as you would anything else. There is a new approach that we're studying in terms of how to get the fungus into the orchard, and that's through this endophyte approach. So, you know, the fungi normally are found in nature in the soil, but you can also find sometimes these fungi will become endophytes in the plant, which means they're living in the plant. An endophyte lives in the plant but doesn't harm it. And the insect-killing fungi that we find living in the plant actually provide benefits in terms of insect control. And it's also been seen to suppress some plant diseases, so like the good fungus suppressing the bad fungus. So what we've been looking at is inoculating trees with these beneficial fungi and get them to live in the tree as an endophyte and provide kind of a built-in defense against pests and disease. That's what we're working towards now.
The goal of incorporating beneficial fungi into a field or orchard is ultimately to reduce the reliance on chemical insecticides. However, it can be a cost saver as well on inputs.
If we can get, for example, the endophyte approach to work well, then from what we see, the endophyte trees that we've created will last several years at least. You know, we're still recording data on those so that you wouldn't have to necessarily spray each year. So that would be a savings. Then when you're talking about, you know, using with other approaches, we think that's feasible as well. So you might not do away with chemical insecticides completely, but you might combine with the beneficial fungi, one application of each, or even sometimes apply them together. There have been instances where the beneficial fungi, the entomopathogenic fungi, combined with certain insecticides, chemical insecticides, cause a synergistic level of mortality in the target insect, in which case you can conceivably use less of each and get a savings that way, or just get a higher level of control of the target pest.
Shapiro Ilam believes the same technique of using beneficial fungi for control of pests in pecan can be replicated in other nut crops as well in the future. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Charlstrom.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.